The mother of sharks actually comes from Mick Fanning. He was one of the first ones to use it, although some of my former students who are here, to whom maybe I taught their dive master instructor course or taught them any of the courses, they sometimes they call me shark mama.
Okay.
And it comes from the protective and nurturing nature that I have towards sharks, especially the removal of the hooks and taking care and worrying about them and wanting to protect them.
Christina Zanotto joins us this week on episode 37 of Dive in the Podcast. Welcome to Dive in the Podcast, your favorite podcast about all types of diving, scuba tech, freediving, and more. We cover it all. Every week on Monday, we post new episodes filled with diving news, interesting dive topics, ocean advocacy, and much more. To learn more about our show, or find your favorite guest, or just read about the hosts, be sure to check out our website, diveinpod.com. Hi, everybody. I'm Justin.
I'm Nick.
I'm Amit.
And we're the hosts of Dive in the Podcast. Tonight, we're speaking with Christina Zanotto. Christina Zanotto is a PADI course director, NSSCDS, Advanced Cave Diving Instructor, TDI Technical Diving Instructor, and specializes in shark diving and shark behavior. She's well known for her work with Caribbean reef sharks in the Bahamas and initiated the movement that led to the full protection of sharks in the Bahamas. Along with making giant strides in cave exploration, she's a member of the Woman Diver Hall of Fame, Explorers Club, the Ocean Arts Society, and the recipient of the SSI Platinum Pro 5000. Welcome to Dive in the Podcast, Christina. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It is a pleasure.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
Very good, thank you. It's actually nice, cool weather finally in the Bahamas.
Oh, that's nice. It was cold here. It was below freezing all day where I'm at, so cool weather as well.
Cool weather means below 80s, so that we can actually breathe.
I guess a different, little bit different sliding scale there, eh?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to our interview with you in a couple of minutes. But before that, Nick, last week you set up the interview with our guest, Underwater Pat. That was a pretty fun interview.
It was a lot of fun to do, yeah. Looking forward to listening to that when we air it.
Yeah, he's quite a character, and he's got a story about everything. So it was pretty fun.
More or less, his energy throughout that interview was kind of infectious, right? Like you're sitting around, and then you just have, you're forced into being in a good laughing mood just because he's just such a jovial fella. So quite enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's why he's a science communicator, and we're just
that's right.
I just regret we couldn't ask him about his Instagram Sharky Shark.
I know. We'll have to have him back and do a segment on his Sharky Shark. Christina, what's the biggest, deepest pool you've ever been in?
Oh, I think the one where I work at is about 17 feet deep, and it's about Olympic size, so 25 meters by 10 meters.
Yeah, we have a pool here in Halifax. It's kind of the same size, and to me it feels gigantic. But the world's deepest pool has just opened in Poland, and it beat out the old Y-40 in Italy by 5 meters. So it's now 45 meters. It accommodates scuba divers and free divers, has a cave area, a simulated wreck area, and holds the equivalency of 27 Olympic pools worth of water. Out of the water, it has a tunnel through the middle of the pool. It has hotel rooms, a restaurant, conference rooms. It sounds like a kind of wild place, but I wouldn't want to be the poor person stuck vacuuming the bottom.
I was reading about it today. Just today I read about the deepest pool in Poland.
Yeah, the pictures look pretty neat. But yeah, one of them was literally somebody there vacuuming the pool. And I was like, oh, poor lady.
It's going to make a lot of freedivers happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about that Poland, though, weather-wise, I would imagine make a lot of scuba divers happy, too. And I recall like looking at videos of Tomasz Miczur doing pool practice, and I can only imagine how overjoyed he would be about that pool. So, I mean, I just keep wishing somebody would do that in Halifax, but somehow I don't think we have the population demographics to support it.
If I ever hit that $1 billion lottery or something, I'll build us a pool. That'll work. So enough of the news. Let's dive in with Christina. Before you learned how to scuba dive in the Bahamas, you actually grew up in the rainforest of the Congo. What was that like?
Well, that's correct. It was good. It was nice. It was obviously a life out of what we consider standards of both, I would say, an American or Italian standards. That's where I'm from. It was free. It was very much in contact with nature. And I think it kind of like set up the foundations of what is my relationship with nature, which is one of knowledge and respect and not necessarily just removing everything to make everything around me safe.
Right. You were drawn to water at a very young age. What was your first memory of the water?
My first memory is with my mom and dad. And I remember it was being able, I always had a mask, I can't remember the age, and fins. But one of the things that I wanted to do is emulate my dad, who was a free diver, obviously a diver. And so the things that I used to ask him to help me with is actually to push me down. So he would kind of like grab me and just, you know, hold me by the waist and say, all right, kick. And then he will tilt me and just obviously most likely I will descend 3 feet. Yeah. And then, you know, bob back up. But to me, it's like I reached the bottom of the abyss and I was just like the happiest girl that obviously I could do what dad was doing.
My daughter is 6 and her favorite thing to do is ride on my shoulders to the bottom of the pool. And then when she's out of breath, push up to the surface and she thinks that's the coolest thing. So that's, I can only imagine. Well, she'll be in a few years following in your footsteps.
Hopefully.
So I was wondering, Christina, what your first dive experience then was like. Because obviously with that sort of love of the water coming from such an early age, you, did you go right into diving? And what was that experience like?
I didn't go straight into scuba diving. I was a free diver and always in the water, but I had to wait till I was 22 years old to have the right amount of time and money to put myself through scuba school, because my dad and the country I was in, the mentality was the scuba diving was too dangerous for women. It was not designed for us. And so I actually took a trip here to the Bahamas to do my scuba certification and in a week time flipped my entire life over. And yes, this is where I did my first scuba dive ever during my certification. And it was in this crystal clear water with this sharks everywhere, reef of fish, and the capacity I never seen before in my life. I never seen water this clear and life so abundant. And when I surfaced, I was like, you have sharks here? And the instructor was kind of like very nonchalantly, yeah, of course we have sharks. What a question. And it was one of the reasons why I decided to change everything and come back here to continue scuba diving.
What was your first shark encounter like?
It was here on my first 40-foot certification dive when I submerged into this clear sandy bottom. The sand is so beautiful. Sometimes it even just has rainbows from the surface light. The water is so clear. And there was these Caribbean reef sharks just cruising placidly all around. And like I said, I did my first certification dive among sharks. And in a certain way, maybe I was spoiled, but I surfaced extremely inspired by it. And I thought it was the coolest experience that I had been able to witness sharks from the first scuba dive ever.
Wow, that sounds incredible. So, I mean, obviously that first encounter led to significantly more encounters. And I think right now you're probably internationally, well, not probably, you're definitely internationally known for your work with Caribbean reef sharks. And I think you've garnered a few names like Shark Dancer. And like, I think one of them that I found that I was really interested in as well was the Mother of Sharks. And so how did you come to earn that title? Like, how does that happen?
The Mother of Sharks actually comes from Mick Fanning. He was one of the first ones to use it. Although some of my former students who are here, to whom maybe I taught their dive master or instructor course or taught them any of the courses, they sometimes they call me Shark Mama.
Okay.
It comes from the protective and nurturing nature that I have towards sharks, especially the removal of the hooks and taking care and worrying about them and wanting to protect them. A Shark Dancer comes more from the fluidity by which I stand in the middle of them. And one of the things I do during my course is I stretch my arms out and I spin in circle. And have just the sharks just swim around me, well knowing who I am and what I'm doing, and all of them just glide around me, never bump into the arms and into the hands or anything. My favorite is a Mother of Sharks, or Shark Mama, as they call me here. But right. Mother of Sharks is my favorite. The one I don't like, honestly, is a Shark Whisperer.
Shark Whisperer, okay. So why not?
Because a Shark Whisperer, in a certain way, for me implies that I am doing something to the sharks, like I'm telling them something or manipulating them through whatever capacity. And I am not doing that. I consider myself more of a shark listener. So I watch shark behavior and I adapt myself to them to have an encounter that is positive primarily for them and then for me and then for the observers.
Right. Okay.
So it's based on time and experience together. It's not just, it's not a magic snapping on my fingers. I go down there and whispers to the sharks and the sharks just magically do something that they never done before.
Right.
You mentioned earlier about removing the shark hooks from the mouths of the sharks, and that makes me think of that tonic immobility. Tell our listeners about that, because it's a pretty amazing thing.
Some people call it tonic immobility, and I used to call it tonic immobility till I started reading a little bit more into it. So tonic immobility is a reaction of many animals, not only sharks, to situations of stress or threat. Once I start analyzing the relationship and how the sharks go to sleep into my lap, which is their decision, I realized maybe it was not really a tonic immobility, also because they're still very aware. Like if somebody suddenly moves around them, they'll slip out of my lap and swim away. So I would say it's more a relaxed state in which they appreciate in a certain way my touch. And through that, I'm able to verify, for example, like the position of the hooks, but not all hooks are removed when the shark lays in my lap. Some of them are removed as the shark swims by. So it is an interaction that is initiated by the animals. Not all my sharks like to lay in my lap and is initiated however they want and however long they feel to stay.
That's interesting. I always thought it was this magic button you press on a shark. It sounds to me that it's a little bit more like a dog letting you rub its belly.
Yes, or I actually try, I don't try to compare sharks, but one that brings the concept home is a cat. If you talk to cat owners, there's a, there's a cat that will come in your lap, but if you try to pick up that cat at any different other time, it will wiggle out of your hands. It's like, well, not right now. You're not going to touch it.
Right.
So like they're running the show kind of thing, and yes, you're welcome to do it on their terms. One of the things I was wondering too is you seem, and I've seen this in some of the BBC coverage of the work that you've done, but you appear to be completely at home when you're surrounded by a big shiver of sharks, but you're still regularly wearing a chainmail suit. Can you tell us about your decision to wear the suit, and does that have anything to do with the relaxed state? Some folks have kind of postulated that it had to do with, you know, with the electrical fields that might be generated. Is there anything to that?
That was a very good question. So the suit, I wear it when I specifically work with the sharks because I carry food as a reward, like you would carry treats when you do dog behaviors. And as I have such a close proximity, also when I remove the hooks, I protect myself in order to protect the sharks. If I was to go down on a regular dive to take pictures of the sharks or measure them with the photogrammetry, I would not need to wear a suit. So it's only when I directly interact and work with them. The suit, I disagree that is the reason why the sharks goes to sleep, but I also agree, but it's not that the suit creates an electric magnetic field. I think what the suit does is what I call the barrier that drops the barrier between me and the sharks. So by wearing the suit, I relax, right? If you go a mountain climbing, you're wearing a helmet and a harness while you're climbing, you also have, you're more relaxed. And by being more relaxed, obviously, the energy that I exude is also more relaxing. But if that was true, that anyone wearing the chainmail could put sharks to sleep, then all I would need is to put someone on a chainmail and reach out, touch the shark, and the shark will go to sleep. And that doesn't happen.
Right. That's really interesting because, like, certainly I'm no biologist or anything to that point, but I used to watch, well, I still watch just about any documentary I could get my hands on, but my initial thoughts were surrounding, like, you know, that the electrical fields generated and how they're reading that with that, you know, the ampullae of Lorenzini, these sorts of things where, you know, you have the ability to transmit a signal and they're so sensitive where, you know, they can pick up vibrations in waters. And I guess when you're telling me it from the way that you are positioning it there, I wonder too if like the suit is reducing that electrical signal and maybe that gives the shark a more relaxed feel because we're not generating as much. Do you know if there's anything to that effect around it?
That I don't know, because I teach this experience. It's not a course. I call it a course. It's a shark handling course. And I take people down there that want to come in this closeness with the sharks. It's, I think, the only place in the world where somebody will say, reach out and pet the shark on the head. Mm-hmm. And when it does not matter, we're wearing the chain suit. But for example, if I have a student that is extremely nervous, the sharks right. will take a wider berth around the student and come more to me rather than going to the person that is nervous. If I have a student that is extremely relaxed, they'll actually approach the student in much easier way. And both the students are wearing the chain suit. So I think they can right. still feel whatever is the heartbeats and the brainwaves beyond the chain suit. Like I said, to me, the chain suit, I think, just makes the person more relaxed and more comfortable. And mm-hmm. that is what then allows the sharks to relax around those people.
Okay.
That's really interesting. I was just wondering, there are some people that would argue that, you know, wildlife should be observed without touching, and other people in the ocean, you know, I'm thinking of Ocean Ramsay and that interaction with the great white that was really controversial. What value does your brand of shark interaction bring to sharks or to people? I was wondering what your take was on that.
Well, my first take is I wish we didn't have to do sometimes what we do in order to see or connect people with sharks. But that would also be, then that means sharks will not be in peril and people's perceptions of sharks would not be the incorrect one that we have right now amongst the population, including kids that are 3 to 5 years old, have yet to learn how to swim, but they're already afraid of sharks. And it's a fear that is ingrained in our society beyond reasonable justifications. One of the values of this is you bring up a different image of the animals and is an image that is more realistic. But also the people that I take down and share this with me become ambassadors for the sharks themselves. And for me, communication is very important. A lot of that I interact with come from countries of which I don't even speak the language. But thanks to English, we can communicate together. But they go back and transfer this in those languages and in those cultures that I wouldn't be able to approach because of my shortcomings in cultural capability or language capabilities. And so I have touched places like China or Japan or even remote places. I actually had to look once on the map, like Georgia in the former USSR, Czech Republic, just to mention some of, you know, Poland, some of the languages that obviously are beyond my reach. And you create ambassadors and you create people that then speak for the sharks and speak for their conservation. Because the issue that we have is sharks are in danger for the most part by the human presence in the ocean, the coastal developments, the pollution of the water, the overfishing, bycatch, and ultimately also the finning, which is sometimes people only concentrate on that, but they forget all the other things that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in 2011, I think the Bahamas joined the short list of countries to ban shark finning. What was your role in that movement, and was it meant for the conservation efforts in general and the people of the Bahamas?
Well, actually, the Bahamas joined the short list where it declared sharks completely protected, not only from finning, but also from landing, from exploitation of any parts, from any kind of import or export. My contribution was one of the shark tourism, which is a financial income for this country. And so demonstrating that a live shark makes more money for the country than a dead shark. And the live shark is repetitive money as well. There's been estimates that a female shark in a lifespan of 20 years can literally earn $300,000 for the country where the sharks are protected from tourism alone. So there's an economical value. But I started a petition that collected about 25,000 signatures and was the initial push for then the Bahama National Trust and the Pew organization to pick up the campaign and declare the Bahamas a shark sanctuary. This has economical value, as I said, but it also has a economical indirect value. This is still a fishing country, and protecting sharks protects the fisheries and creates healthier environment where actually it's much easier for the fishers to find different variety and healthy variety of fish.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was thinking finning because you were just talking about finning and asked you about shark fishing. But definitely having the whole ecosystem is definitely going to produce it's going to be better for everybody.
You've been diving for quite some time, and I imagine over the years in the Bahamas, you've probably seen a lot of change. Are you more optimistic about the future of the oceans today than when you first started diving?
Oh, that's a tough question. Unfortunately, I am not sure. I don't have the whole answer. The changes I've seen in localized here are not for the better, but actually have been for the worse. Especially, we've been having quite a lot of coral diseases, algae blooms. I am more optimistic in the awareness that people have now compared to 26 years ago. I am more optimistic in the capabilities of people of understanding that we may not like sharks, but we need sharks and we need to protect them. And that is where the optimism comes, is there's actually more people willing to fight for a better ocean and for a better environment. And so although the conditions have in a certain way declined, there's also more people that are ready to make these conditions overturn. And we know the oceans can recover. World War II was a great example in the North Sea. We know if we leave something for 20 years by themselves, even 20 years is good enough for the ocean to do a pickup. So my optimism actually lies in the hands of other people that have picked up this bottle compared to 26 years ago. We were solitary voices.
So I guess just to follow up on that one, I know we had done an interview with a friend of yours, Alana Velikot, a little while back, and she had posted some stuff, which I've seen reported here about the Bahamas looking to start some offshore oil exploration. You know, how do you feel that's going to interact with the work that you've done?
Well, I actually did some posts as well and encouraged people to sign the petition from Our Island, Our Future, because I am against the oil drilling that has been approved for the waters. First of all, one of them extremely close to one of the marine protected areas of the Bahama National Trust. The oil drilling has, I think, a too short term of a positive effect, which is not actually beneficial to the Bahamians, but as they say in some of the interviews to their shareholders, I'm like, yeah, that's great. But should something happen, and unfortunately oil drilling does not have a very positive history, the Bahamas will be left with fork in the bill. Mm-hmm. And it is going to be an extremely expensive bill when you have a country that relies on tourism and fisheries as a two of the main sources of income. I think oil drill is not the answer. And I am into the same battle to try to stop this decision.
Right. And I think, being, I guess, a person from the Caribbean as well, I was born in Trinidad and Tobago, and Trinidad is very much an oil producing oil, and natural gas as well. And when I compare Trinidad as an example to my experiences in the Bahamas, and I've been there to Trinidad numerous times and to the Bahamas at least three or four times, there's a stark and striking difference between, the coastal areas and the impact environmentally. And in fact, our shark populations there are pretty much decimated as a result of pollution and overfishing and these other things that you have fought to protect in them. So I think at least for me, speaking as a Caribbean guy, and I think Nick would probably say the same, I feel very much in line with what you're saying. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing there.
Thank you.
I wanted to mention as well, some of the work that you're doing, it's related to a company called UNEXCO Divers, if I'm not mistaken. And so when I was in Grand Bahama last, we're talking maybe like 6 or 7 years ago, I happened to stroll in. This was long before I was a diver. And, and I thought like, hey, I want to go try one of these shark excursions. And I have to say, the fella at the counter just tossed me out of the store in a very polite way and said, just because you did a Discover Scuba, we're not particularly going to take you down and put you into one of these scenarios. So why don't you do yourself a favor and go get trained first, and then come back and we'd be happy, or sign up for a class. And, you know, so I did that, kind of started my my path to diving, because really it was this attraction to wanting to go diving and seeing and experiencing sharks that started it for me as well. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your work and how that intersects with UNEXCO.
The work that I conduct is the educational part. So I'm a course director for PADI, so I do the training for dive masters and instructors. There's a school program that teaches school kids in a public school on the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, the open water advance and rescue, and is part of their curriculum. I trained the original teacher, and then we set up this program together. And that the concept is to train Bahamians into the trade of scuba diving, to then outgrow this platform and then expand into different environments. So my primary job is then pick them up after they come out of high school and list a supply of teenagers. Yes. My favorite. And to train them once they turn 18 into the business of scuba diving, with the concept of basically saying, hey, this is an alternative to fishing. This is an alternative to more traditional jobs. And quite a lot of them have moved into very good positions, from like boat captains, yacht masters, into school teachers, biology teachers, environmentalists, even a police task force who is run by someone who understands about sharks and shark fins and will control the ports and making sure that there's no contraband of these animals. So they don't just sit there and just stay diving instructor, but then they become, they bring this knowledge into the different environments of the world that they do. And then I obviously manage the shark dive, the rules, the training of all the people that are involved into the safety from a staff point of view, observation point of view. So that is quite a lot of my educational role.
Wow, that sounds like it has a really long lasting impact. Like, you know, it goes well beyond just the individual experience and is really affecting things at a systemic level in the Bahamas. So yeah, that's some fantastic work.
Well, take this time to take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back with more from Christina Zanotto. Hi everyone, I just wanted to take a second to thank our sponsor, Torpedo Rays Scuba. Torpedo Rays is a local dive shop in Nova Scotia. If you're not in Nova Scotia, that's okay. They've got a wonderful website, torpedorays.com, TORPEDORAYS.com. All of the scuba gear you could ever need is there. If you can't find it, give Jason a call, 902-481-0444, and he'll be happy to help you out. And in these challenging times, it's always great to shop local. Don't go to a huge, big box. Help support your local dive shop. Buy something you've had your eye on. Excellent time to make a good deal. Buy a gift certificate to use later. Whatever the case may be, Torpedo Rays and torpedorays.com will be there for you. Once again, their number is 902-481-0444 or torpedorays.com. Welcome back. You're listening to our chat with Christina Zanotto on Dive In the Podcast. So, Christina, what was your introduction to cave diving, and why are you drawn to cave?
My first introduction to cave diving, which actually was a cavern tour that I completed as my 11th ever log dive, with my mentor, the person that became then my mentor for shark diving, Ben Rose. Unfortunately, he passed away last year, but I signed up for this cavern tour, and I really didn't know what to expect. And what I entered was a crystal clear environment. If the ocean water was crystal clear, this water looked like air. And I watched Ben float in this mid-air rather than mid-water. And it then took us on this trip across this enormous decorations that look like sleeping giant coming out of the fog, kind of like something out of the Lord of the Rings, and crystals that glowed as you shine your lamp through them. And just, I felt like I entered a geological history book of this planet. It was just like, imagine I've been in a giant library, and it's just like, I opened this big book, and it was like, it was like, and here's the story of the planet. So I fell in love with that part, the magical feel. The darkness and the overhead never really scared me from that point of view. It fascinated me. It would take me 2 more years to then become a cave diver. And then I started diving the lines, the caves that already had lines. And when I started running out of lines and caves already being explored, I started to explore. And the more I dived, the more I found that there was a connection actually between the caves and the island and the mangroves and the sharks, and that if I wanted to protect one, I had to protect the other. And it was not just these cells that were independent from each other, but it was just this massive, huge ecosystem. I personally love cave diving. I find that time in the cave doesn't tick. Yes, there is the time of your decompression. There is the time of your gas. If you're a breather, you don't even have that. There are other times, but time in itself of the, oh, I have this appointment. Oh, I have to do this. Oh, at this time I have this call. That doesn't exist. It just, the cave was, is, and will be like that for a very long time, beyond any possible lifespan of a human being. And so it has kind of like a frozen in time. When I'm in the cave, it could have been 26 years ago or 26 years from now. Mm. And I love that. It has a very peaceful feeling. Like I said, it has this geological history. I can read the rocks and see and imagine. I can hear the water dripping. I can hear the flow of the rain. It's a place that teaches you about the concept of now. Mm. On being present, of being within yourself, and teaches quite a lot of life lessons as well.
Sounds a lot like freediving.
In a way, yes, with a much lot of more gear. But
Christina, that was probably one of the coolest explanations I've heard, I think, to date, as to what attracts a person to being a cave diver or to caves in general. But you didn't just stop there, right? Like you are now a very well-known cave instructor. Can you tell us a bit about your path to becoming a cave instructor? Because that can't be something that you just wake up one day and you're like, meh, I feel I'm going to be a cave instructor tomorrow. Like there's a lot involved in that.
Yes, when I became a cave diver and I started diving, I realized that I actually wanted to share this with people. And I remember I contacted my cave instructor back to go to Florida to do my course because there was no one here to teach me. And he basically said, oh, you need to do this course, this course, this course, this course. And there was something about the procedure that I didn't like. I was like, no, I just don't want to come in and do 2 weeks and tick a couple of boxes. I think the cave diving is like almost like surfing. If you talk to a surfer, they tell you it's a lifestyle. They move where the waves are. So you think cave diving is a lifestyle. And luckily, I met the chairman of training of the NSSCDS, the National Speleological Society Cave Diving Section, Jenny Willis. And he didn't tell me who he was, but he came on the island when cave diving and he said, have you ever thought about teaching? And I said, yes, I would love to, but I don't want to just take a course. I said, I want to do an internship. And he said, well, that's what we do in the CDS. It's a mentorship program. And that was about a year and a half of work. You have things that you have to complete. You co-teach classes. So you actually side by side with seasoned cave instructors, you follow them and you first listen and then you teach a little piece and then you teach another piece. And by the time you go to your institute, your exams, you have taught. I remember for my first and second level, I had co-taught 15 different classes of the two different levels. And then you have to wait 1 year between one level and the other. And during that year, you have to co-teach the second level, and you have teachers some of the first level, in you must wait a year. You must gain a year experience in teaching before you go for the second one. So it is commitment. Mm. And they want to see that. They want to see the dedication, but they also want to see kind of like the lifestyle, I think. That is how I did mine. And I, to this day, I'm very pleased that I did that, because when I came back to the island and somebody says, I want to learn your cavern class, I remember, opposite of other instructor levels, that I was just going to say, sure, I can teach that class A to Z blindfolded.
Right.
Because I had taught that class over and over and over again to real students under the supervision of instructors. Where for other instructors level, and of which I'm, you know, part of, I remember finishing, coming back with my instructor, and I was like,
yeah,
okay, I still need to figure it out how to schedule this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We never really did a whole class. We did little snippets. We did little micro teaching, but nobody ever sat me down and said, okay, this is a schedule from A to Z. And that was the difference in the cave diving community. And I think it is fundamental. I mean, we're teaching people to go underground in flooded, completely darkest tunnels. So the only thing that they can rely on besides their gear is their brain. We better train that brain really, really well. And so there's a lot of emphasis in cave diving on positive motivations, on identify people that have negative motivations, on personal motivations, on red flag syndromes. And then the psychological of, if you are 3,000 feet inside the cave and something goes wrong, you have to be able to keep it together for 3,000 feet and constantly solve that issues as you come out. You better not lose it or you're going to kill yourself.
That's super fascinating. What advice would you have for a person that's interested in cave diving, and how would you tell them to prepare before taking a course?
Those people that are interested in cave diving obviously are required to already be certified divers with some level of experience. Buoyancy, trim, propulsions are three of the most important from a physical point of view. My recommendations are pick an instructor who is also diving for fun. This has always been my choice of instructor. But for fun, I mean, it's an instructor that, yes, is teaching, but is also he or she are out there doing a trip or learning something new or actually cave exploring, but doing something beyond the level at which they teach. They're not just teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an instructor that, to me, is excited. It has more hands-on reality experience that can bring to the table. If you pick an instructor who's only teaching and ticking the boxes, they're only going to teach that kind of like cookie cutter style.
Right.
But if they never go beyond the level at which they teach, 400 feet inside a cave, they can never really tell me about that story of what happened when something failed 5,000 feet in. And it's not to scare me, but they can bring in that extra, oh, I've learned that. And I've learned this. And so I'm going to put this into my class. So that's one. If you want to go into cave diving, you cannot be cheap. I'm sorry, but you cannot go and buy a secondhand spacer suit. And that's where we're going.
Yeah.
I say, oh, don't worry about the little crack on the head of your spacesuit. It's going to be fine, right? So it's the same concept. You can't be cheap. You need the gear. You need to love your gear. You need to take care of it. And you cannot cut corners, because there's no corners to cut. Like Ed Viesa said, there's no shortcuts to the top. He was the first American to complete the 14,000 meters peaks in the world. But it's the same concept. So that goes together with the third suggestion, which is slow down. Take your time. Take your first level and then dive at that level. Acquire experience. There are limitations that we put into the training and where you can go and what you can do, because we know that is that the limits at which you can actually educate your brain. I call it muscle memory.
Mm-hmm.
Underwater, there's nothing in our animal background that will help us underwater. The fight or flight syndrome doesn't work underwater. It's going to kill you. And in a cave, it's going to kill you even faster. So what we do is we created, I call it a trained instinct. I will train you to react to something instinctually, but it's not instinctual. It's trained, and it's trained through experience, through repetition, through dedication. So slow down, stay at that level, do quite a lot of diving, gain your experience, become comfortable, then go for the next level.
Thank you very much for that. I wanted to go back really quickly because you made a comment, and I think it ties into what you're just talking about right now a little bit with the, you know, staying at the level and potentially slowing things down. You had mentioned that you look out when you're in the process of, I guess, assessing people and or training them for red flags along the way. So what exactly are you looking for that is going to be a red flag for you that maybe somebody either should or shouldn't be pursuing this?
Well, some of the red flags is one of the most dangerous one is the basically perceived dangers of cave diving and the concept that if I do this, I'm cheating death or mm-hmm. I am, or the other red flag is this is not going to happen to me. And I think one of the worst red flags for me is, and you can find that through conversation, is the cutting corners.
Right.
What they call complacency of defiance, which mm-hmm. was created for the challenger.
Yeah.
The fact that you're, oh, well, I've done this before and I got away with it. So that's I'm right. going to keep doing this, but it's beyond the rules and it's beyond what I actually have been taught. And yes, we can get away with it. That's for sure. But we keep doing that till the day we are not getting away with it. And then it's going to catch us in a position where we're not trained or equipped, or we haven't respected some of the rules that actually will make us go out. And you can hear that in people's conversation when I send a little questionnaire. So tell me a little bit about yourself. You know, how many dives do you have? Where have you been? Why are you diving? Why do you want to become a cave diver? And mm-hmm. some of them already give me some parameters of the person that I'm dealing with. And right. that to me, the, I've done this before, it's not going to happen to me, and because I broke rules before, but, you know, nothing went wrong, I think maybe that's one of the worst red flags for me.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And so I wanted to shift gears a little bit, but still stay on the topic of caves for a second, and ask you this question, because I thought it was really interesting, that you are one of these people that you're talking about where you're diving and you're doing cave exploration on your own while still teaching. And you have been, I guess, listed as one of the first people in the world to have connected inland caves to blue holes in the ocean. And I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about that exploration and how you were able to make that happen.
Yes, so that was a connection I did in 2012 after almost 5 to 6 years of work. The blue holes in the Bahamas are tidal dependent. So they either blow water like a spring in Florida, or they siphon water in. So they suck water in mm-hmm. on alternative times. And it's usually 6 hours for each cycle. So twice per day for the cycles. But because of the Little Bahama Bank, there's also a delay. So the tidal cycles keeps changing from day to day. So within a week, when the hole was blowing in the morning, if you go back this morning, a week later, it's siphoning. And you need to know which tide is going to happen while you're in the cave in order to be able to not be trapped in while they're sucking the water in, or you're not going to be able to climb your way out. So I did quite a lot of the exploration from the ocean side on the correct tide, but that required to match the right amount of, you know, the day off that I could go and do this with the correct tide, with daylight, because it's in the middle of the ocean, so it's not that I can find it at 3 o'clock in the morning, even if the tide is right, and with the correct visibility, and hopefully there's not big waves, because obviously I can't swim out there with all the gear if it's too big. And then the land part, and the land part was, visibility was really bad because it's under a community with some development issues and so some pollution. And what I kept doing is pushing from one side to the other. I've been told that they didn't connect. The very famous explorer called Rob Palmer, who actually wrote The Chimney, the ocean blue hole I was diving in, was the most dangerous cave he had ever attempted to dive in his life. He wrote that in his book. I was laying line, and then going back in and trying to figure it out where it went. And it felt like I was always hitting a wall. Till one day, I don't know, maybe the visibility was different or something. I remember looking at the wall. It was always in this area where I always split to the right, to the left. And I could never find the lead. And I looked at the wall and I'm like, well, that's not a wall. That is actually a giant piece of rock that cracked and came down and is vertical in front of me. And so I swam all the way to it. And I put my forehead, my head, the top of my head against it. And I looked to my left. And all of a sudden, I realized there was like a passage through. Now, into brackets, all of this is done in side mount. Mm-hmm. I could not any of do this on back mounted, so I'm in side mounted tanks. And so I slid through that. And then from there, all of a sudden, the cave seemed to almost like relinquish what it kept for me for years. But it took a lot of attempts just because of the different tides and also because of the different vis. I remember to come out of chimney, it's a 40-foot shaft. When you come out and the tide is blowing, you come out basically like Spider-Man on a wall. You need to plaster yourself against the walls or it's going to blow you all the way to the surface.
Wow.
And so I will carry the reel in, and at the reel where I tied into my other line, I will let down ankle weights and gloves. And then when coming out, I will clip the ankle weights at the bottom of my gear to make me butt heavy, which is not what we want in cave diving, but just to, so that I could stay vertical in the hole and keep my fins down, and then put gloves on so I wouldn't get cut by the rocks. So I took some quite a lot of, you know, like little tricks of the trade. Wow. But it was that wall. It was that wall that day. I put my forehead against it. And I remember looking to the left, and I was just kind of like, I can slide through this.
It's really that sense of exploration coming through, right? When, you know, like you say, you're going to adapt and overcome, because it probably, I'm assuming from what you're describing, the average person would look at that and say, yeah, you know, I'm not going in there. So it sounds like you really have that explorer spirit behind you there.
Yes, but it's based on all the years that I spent first to swim in the lines and understanding. I tell people that the cave speaks to me. The cave doesn't really speak to me, like I don't speak to the sharks. But once you start cave diving and you start reading a geology book, all of a sudden you start realizing what are the patterns. And so we are currently exploring two systems that we just found in 2020. Next time somebody says 2020 was a bad year, I said, I know, I just found two full virgin cave systems on an island. Sorry. And I mean, what are the odds?
Yeah.
And we exploring it. And as you first explore, you go, okay, the cave does this. But as you keep exploring it, the eyes become adjusted to those small changes. Mm-hmm. And the other day I was looking at it and I said, this cave is on different levels. And I found a section of the cave that was 10 feet below where we're exploring right now.
Yeah.
It took me several dives to feel the cave, right? So as you swim the lines, and that's where you take it slow. You don't start exploring right out of cave class.
Mm-hmm.
You want to swim those lines. And when you want to swim them repetitively and let things happen, and then when you reach the end of the line, is because you've swum all the other lines. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things. Don't zoom to the end of the line 2 days after your cave class. Take your time, because the cave has quite a lot to say. Last year, I found over 6,000 feet of new cave in a system that had been explored since the 1980s. And had been explored by dozens of people and have been dozens of cave divers of quite big names in it. And they were like, oh, yeah, well, this system is done. And I was in it and I'm like, it's not done. And I put in 6,000 plus feet in a cave that had been explored 30 years ago. We just recently put in another 5,000 feet on the back of a cave that has been there another 30 years explored.
Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, like you're saying, it's like that passion, the sense that you allow the cave to kind of speak to you and absorb what you're seeing around you. It's like you're almost like reading the situation that you're in. You can just kind of feel it, is how I'm hearing it in any event. But that's an incredible kind of ability to be able to perceive something that we think of as being a completely inanimate object, but you're giving it a sense of animation, if that comes through, right?
Yes, that's correct. It is, to me, the cave is animated, and it is animated in its sediments. It's animated in the way the water moves through it. Right now, we've installed even flow meters and depth sensors because we want to really know what's happening here, what's happening with the tides, why is the water moving this way, and what is water movement is causing to the entire cave system. And when this cave system goes from the beach all the way inland and is almost connecting the south shore to the north shore, what does it mean from, for example, a pollution point of view? What does it mean during a hurricane? One of the caves we're exploring right now has trees that have like 8, 9 feet diameter in the middle of the passageways, thousands of feet from the entrance, and you're thinking, wow, the amount of water that had to flow through here during Hurricane Dorian, for example. So the cave is alive and it has all this information.
Wow, that's incredible to hear.
I wanted to ask you, but something a little bit different. You founded an organization called People of the Water to help change people's relationship with the aquatic world. And I guess as divers, we already have a connection there in some sense. But can you tell us a little bit about People of the Water?
People of the Water was founded in January, sorry, 2019. The way I worked up to that time was as a diving professional, and whatever I could put in on the side, for example, all the work of exploration and mapping and conservation of quite a lot of systems on the island that are now part of marine protected area was done on my own time, with my own finances, buying my gear, lines, anything that I needed. Same as the education, quite a lot before COVID. Quite a lot of trips that I did were self-financed to go and speak at conventions, to go and speak into aquariums, to go and speak to people. And so the People of the Water was born to maybe give me the opportunity to expand this outreach through financial support, both for gear, but also for being able to reach more people when I do educational programs. This is the initial part. The continuation of this is obviously to expand research. One of them was blocked this year because of COVID, but we're trying to figure it out where the Caribbean reef sharks are now protected, go to mate and give birth. Because I do believe that sharks are protected, but we also need to protect their food and where they go to leave their youngs and where they go to mate. Otherwise, it's not really a full protection. And I do believe it is connected with caves. So we're purchasing satellite tags to follow some of my girls when they're going to be pregnant and ready to mate and say, hey, look, that's where they go. Maybe we need to take in consideration that.
Right.
Furthermore, the nonprofit, what I'm hoping to do in the future is to be able to expand that training that we were talking about. Personally, I would like to see it more expanded to Bahamian girls, but for that will be the first step, and then in general, to girls. Just as an example, nothing against guys. I've had some of the most amazing supporters and champions for me were guys who did not care about gender. But I think women in general need to see maybe more women out there. Because remember, I come from the culture where girls did not go scuba diving because it's too dangerous for girls.
Right.
And I was convinced of that till somebody said, girls go scuba diving. Why don't you go and take a class? So if I can expand the world of girls in a scuba diving world, maybe they'll see us as a model.
Yeah, and I fully support that. You know, coming from the Caribbean, it's a very patriarchal kind of a culture. And being a father of a young daughter, the last thing I ever want her growing up thinking is, you can't do this because you're a girl. So yeah, that sounds like some really cool work, and I love the fact that it's focused in at trying to develop that aspect for Bahamian girls. So, and just yet another great example of work that you're doing there. Thank you very much for the things that you're doing.
Thank you.
So where can people find out about these projects and find you online?
So I am online on social media. With my name and also my website. So it's www.cristinazenato.com. Cristina is without an H, Cristinazenato. And that is both all the social medias, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I answer to all the messages people send. Best one is to actually go on the website and through the contact button. If you want to look more into the exploration and the conservation projects, you can go to POWnonprofit.org, which is People of the Water Nonprofit. And that one has the list of all the exploration work that we're doing. Part of it is trying to identify all the caves and blue holes for now on Grand Bahama Island. I would like one day to expand that. And again, this is to provide information for people. Let's say somebody wants to develop a marina. Mm-hmm. And if we can say, now listen, underneath where you want to dig out for a marina, there are actually tunnels of a cave that contains freshwater, that contains history, that contains, that goes to the mangroves and is connected from nutrients to the conservation of these mangroves, and then being able to hopefully direct better development choices, less destructive.
Yeah, I can really resonate with that growing up in the Caribbean. There's always a push for development that is always in contradiction with, you know, limited resources and islands.
Yes, and it doesn't take in consideration the people, the islander. For me, it's very important, and it's like, well, what is the benefit for the people here? Because once they have the benefit, then it's in their best interest to actually do the correct action. And sometimes I find... I watch and I'm like, oh, we're coming here and this is very important, like the oil driller. So this is going to be very beneficial for the shareholders. And I'm like, yeah, that doesn't sound like islanders. That doesn't sound like Bahamians.
Yeah, for sure. You have a very strong connection to the ocean. I mean, it's really evident speaking to you now. What keeps you diving?
I think the first one is the sense of being home when I'm in the ocean, when I'm in the water. I feel home, I feel whole, I feel like I found my place. But the other one is a sense of discovery. I was posting the other day, somebody was asking, oh, I'm a brand new diver, give me, you know, your top 10 bucket list. And I wrote the same site at different times of the day and at night, because you never know what will swim through. You know, a dive site that you see during the day looks completely different at night. So for me, is that sense of discovery, of marvel, and ultimately of privilege, right? It is absolute privilege to be able to be down there, to be part of this ecosystem, to be able to witness some of the most amazing things that I think I ever experienced in my life.
I really like that suggestion of going back to the same dive site at different times.
I really appreciate that. Thanks for joining us tonight, Christina. That's been a wonderful interview. And I know Amit's got a pile of more questions to ask you, but we'll have to have you on another time, talk some more about swimming through some caves. Up next, we've got Amit with the Deco Stop. Amit, what do you got for us this week?
All right. So I wanted to give a little quick chat here on two things that I think are kind of really critical to being able to understand some deco diving. And that would be diffusion and perfusion. So not to be confused with each other. So it's common knowledge that more or less when we breathe, we inspire air, which contains, for simplicity, nitrogen and oxygen, and that the oxygen is used when we inhale and we exhale the carbon dioxide. The process happens because the air that we breathe enters our lungs. It's transferred through bronchioles to alveoli, and then the alveoli are surrounded by these tiny little capillaries, which each being the alveoli and capillary are only about one cell thick. So it makes it easy for gas to diffuse from one to the other. So if you recall your grade 7 science class, diffusion would be the movement of molecules from an area of high concentration to one of low concentration. So if you don't believe me, mix up some food coloring in water, throw a few drops on a paper towel, and voila, you've discovered diffusion. So in terms of the gas in your body, as we use the oxygen, we create this carbon dioxide and we get a change in the partial pressure of the gas. So this change in the partial pressure of the gas is actually what's causing the flow of oxygen in and carbon dioxide out. And the inert gas, which is the nitrogen, just kind of hangs around and it diffuses in and out at a relatively consistent rate when we're at the surface. So where it gets interesting is when we descend below the surface and we start breathing more and more dense air. So if you remember from your open water class that Boyle's law is at play when we descend, and therefore the deeper we go, the more dense the air we breathe becomes. So a full tank of air, I think everybody knows, if you're down at about 100 feet, is about four times as dense. So I guess, why do we care about this then? So we care about this because Henry's law tells us that the gas dissolved in a liquid is directly proportional to the partial pressure of that gas in equilibrium with that liquid. So that can get kind of confusing, but thinking back to the diffusion of gases that we just talked about there, we can do this simply by saying, if we're inhaling gas that's four times as dense, then we're also inhaling more molecules. So that means the blood flowing through the body has more molecules in it, and therefore the diffusion of gases into the tissues happens faster. That means that we reach tissue saturation faster at depth. So if you want to take this back to your recent food coloring experiment where you kind of discovered diffusion, minus the pressure, of course, you can think of it as if you had used a medicine dropper to put one drop at a time onto the paper towel. Eventually you get a saturated paper towel and it can't hold any more water. But of course, if you instead use a tablespoon to pour that water on there, then you would reach saturation faster. So that's where you have to think about the idea of gas and the relative density of the gas becoming an issue, and it's important within diving. So the last part that I wanted to chat about really quickly was perfusion. And this is important because perfusion actually will help to determine the amount of gas that a tissue will absorb in a given amount of time. So perfusion is basically the amount of blood flow that a tissue receives. And so if you think about that in the way that we've just been chatting about it, you've got all this gas that's flowing in your bloodstream, and it needs to reach your tissues for the gas to come out of solution and transfer into the tissue. So obviously then, the more blood that reaches those tissues, the better chance that you're going to get this to happen. So the tissues that receive high blood flow will on gas and off gas quickly. And those we generally talk of as being fast tissues, while tissues that receive a lower blood flow will on and off gas slowly. And of course, they're called slow tissues. So it's important to recognize, not only is diffusion an important process in your taking on gases and removing gases from your system, but perfusion is also a factor that will play a major role in your ability to off gas and on gas. So the two factors come together in a way that can help you protect yourself from issues like the bends. And we'll continue on a bit with this in another episode.
That was certainly an in-depth coverage of all that, but you made it pretty easy to understand, Amit. Thanks for boiling that down there, and I'm sure everybody listening at home is appreciative of it as well. Can't wait to see what happens on the next episode. Before we go, Nick, you've got a book recommendation this week. What have you got for us?
The book recommendation this week is it's actually a marine biology book. It's called Sensuous Seas, Tales of a Marine Biologist, and it was written by Eugene Kaplan of Hofstra University. And it's sort of really like a comical look at marine organisms through a marine biologist's perspective, and how, when he was teaching with students, and you know, whether it was building fish farms in Africa or working in a marine laboratory in Jamaica, and just really a really creative way in which it's written to describe either organisms or, you know, their life cycles or their ecology. So anybody that's got an interest in the oceans and in marine life, you know, you can go pick up a marine biology textbook, you know, typical of what one might get in undergrad. But this book is maybe a little bit more accessible, and it's a really fun read. It's been around since 2006, and I wish I still had a copy because it's a book I'd like to read again. So Sensuous Seas, Tales of Marine Biologists by Eugene Kaplan. If you get a chance to pick that up, either on as an ebook or hardcover, I highly recommend it.
Great recommendation. Well, that does it for today's episode. Thanks again to Christine Zanotto for joining us today. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
And to our co-host, Nick, thanks for being here tonight.
Yeah, thanks again for having us here, Justin. And thank you, Christina, for coming on. And I also kind of want to thank Alana for putting us in touch. And it was a real pleasure to speak to you and Alana, of course. But and we hope maybe to have you back sometime.
Thank you. It will be my pleasure. Thank you, Nick.
And Amit, thanks as always.
I'm going to kind of echo what Nick had to say. I mean, you know, as I mentioned, before I was even a diver, you were a person that I knew about, and kind of was like, whoa, I gotta learn to dive and look at the cool things that she's doing. And then, you know, when you bring us to the point where we had that opportunity to speak to Alana, and she said, you know, like, you guys should talk to a friend of mine. And then she tells us, this friend of mine is Christina Zanotto. And I was just sitting there going like, what, are you joking? Like, you can get us an opportunity to speak to Christina. I was quite blown away. So, you know, like, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. So thank you very much.
That was my pleasure.
You can follow the show on Instagram and Facebook with @divein.thepodcast. Our email is divein.thepodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit our website, www.divinpod.com. On there, you can send us a voice message and find links to our past episodes. On social media, you can find me at iDiveOK. April is at April Weichert. Nick Winkler is at Nicholas Winkler Photography. You can find links for everything we mentioned on today's episode in the show notes or on our website, diveinpod.com. Next week, we speak to adventurer, photographer, and filmmaker from British Columbia, Maxwell Hahn. This episode of Dive in the Podcast was brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Ray Scuba. Head over to your favorite podcast app to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It's very much appreciated. Thanks for listening.